This is the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast, hosted by Chris Mannix. From interviews.
Let's bring in John Wall.
He's Reggie Miller.
Bring in Eric Spoelstra.
To the latest NBA news.
To insights you won't get anywhere else.
Rioting is bad. You shouldn't riot.
Past episodes of the podcast can be downloaded in the iTunes Store and Google Play.
Why wouldn't you go back?
Subscribe and leave a rating or comment. Here he is.
Speaking of guys putting their foot in the road.
Chris Mannix.
Yes.
All right, welcome into another episode of the Yahoo Sports NBA Podcast. Glad you could join me this week. And we're going to take a deep dive into two really interesting teams this week. We're going to talk about the New York Knicks with Frank Izzola, the longtime beat writer for the New York Daily News, now doing a lot of stuff with ESPN, SiriusXM, NBA Radio. The Knicks probably not going to have a great season, but that may not be the objective in New York. They've got a new coach, a newish front office, so maybe looking functional is the best the Knicks can do. We'll talk about that and more with Frank Izzola. A little bit later on, Jeff McDonald from the San Antonio Express News. The Spurs, not the same old Spurs. Not the continuity, not the same names. Kawhi Leonard is gone. What do the new Spurs look like? What does that mean for Greg Popovich? What does that mean for the future of this team? We'll dive into all that and more with Jeff McDonald of the San Antonio Express News. Quick housekeeping note, if you like this podcast, very easy way you can support it. Head over to Apple Podcasts, also known as iTunes. Post a comment, leave a rating. It's simple, it's easy, it's free. It's the best way to make sure we keep doing this podcast week after week. That's it. All right, let's go. All right, joining me now on the podcast, Frank Izzola, the longtime Knicks beat writer. You can catch him nowadays on ESPN, PTI, Around the Horn, all over the place. SiriusXM radio show is the starting lineup Monday through Friday, 7 a.m. to 10 a.m. Does that with my good pal, Brian Scalabrine. How do you do 3 hours a day with Scal, Frank?
Oh, my God. It is not easy. I'd say he's into it. But, you know, you got his kids getting ready to go to school. They're crying in the background because a lot of times he does it from home. So it could be kind of nuts. But he loves basketball. And as you know, Chris, he loves to work and make money. This is a great thing about Brian. Out of nowhere, he said, I have an opportunity to go to Manila. Should I go? I said, you're going to love it. Of course he goes over there. And he doesn't realize how passionate they are for basketball. And they all know the White Mamba. So now he's looking at it like every summer I'm going to go over there now and make a little bit of money.
It's a little another paycheck
yep.
For Scal. All right, so let's talk about the Knicks here. The Knicks haven't been to the playoffs in 5 years, haven't been to the finals almost 20 years, haven't won a championship in 45 years. That said, they are starting to look on the outside like a little bit more of a functional franchise. Scott Perry brought in last summer to run the front office. This summer, David Fizdale brought in as the head coach. Are the Knicks looking more functional to you, Frank?
I think they are. And the funny thing about what you're saying is you're talking about their run of futility here. And here's the interesting thing. It's almost like the fans this season want there to be one more year of futility. That's not to say they don't want to see Kevin Knox develop and see Kristaps Porzingis return to the lineup and be healthy. But I think the fans are looking at it like, all right, let's do this. Let's be one of the worst teams in the league. We have our first-round pick. We'll get a lottery pick, and then we have all this cap space, and maybe we can get Kyrie Irving, maybe we can get Kevin Durant, and then we're really off and running. But to your point, I think they do seem to be headed in the right direction because they're taking advantage of their losing. It looks like they made a pretty good pick with Kevin Knox. They have a new coach. We'll see how it works out with David Fizdale. But I do think the key for next season with them in terms of which way they're really headed is going to be the health of Kristaps Porzingis and deciding whether or not does he come back and play, and if he does play, what does he look like?
Yeah, and look, there are some specifics I want to get into here, Frank, but I don't get the sense that the Knicks care about wins and losses next year. I don't. I think they don't want to do it looking like the gang that can't shoot straight, but if they lose because Porzingis isn't back or because they're playing a teenager in Kevin Knox or trying to develop Frank Ntilikina as a point guard, I don't think they care. I think they're perfectly fine following that path you talked about. Get the high draft pick and then, as a functional franchise, try to recruit one of those top free agents.
And I think it's really become kind of the mindset or even the culture around a lot of NBA franchises. And, you know, everyone looks at Philadelphia and how it worked there. And I think a lot of the Knicks fans and Knicks management is like, you know, if it doesn't work out, and that's why I don't think they will rush back for Porzingis, because once again, they have their pick. So if they finish and get a high lottery pick, it's just another asset for them. And the fans now all over the NBA have been conditioned to think, you know what, losing is not the worst thing. Now, in other franchises, like Utah, they lose a player like Gordon Hayward to free agency. In theory, they don't replace him, except for in the draft, they draft Donovan Mitchell. And lo and behold, that's a team that makes it to the second round of the NBA playoffs. But there are other franchises, and I think the Knicks now fit in that category, and Philadelphia was doing it for a while, was the idea of break it all down and then rebuild. Boston would be another team that really didn't necessarily break it all down. It seems like they, even though they're in theory rebuilding, they've been a couple of steps ahead of everybody else, and they're achieving some success, you know, in terms of postseason.
Well, let's talk for a second about the Fizdale fire, because there are two kind of schools of thought out there about David Fizdale. One is he was this rising assistant on Eric Spoelstra's staff in Miami, won championships, the allegiance of star players. They all liked him, LeBron James, Dwayne Wade, among others, and that he got royally screwed over in Memphis. The flip side of that is that, you know, didn't really accomplish much, you know, with Memphis, clashed with his best player in Marc Gasol, and, you know, got let go, you know, very early into his second season. What's your take on Fizdale?
I think for him, I think, you know, to his credit, when he had his press conference, he did kind of reflect back on it, and he took some accountability for things not going the right way. And as you know, Chris, it's different being an assistant coach, and, you know, you have Dwayne Wade and you have LeBron James and Chris Bosh, and, you know, the team is having the success, and David Fizdale is certainly a part of it. But when you move up that next seat on the bench and you didn't play in the NBA, so right away, you know, to establish credibility with today's NBA players, there are certain ways to go about it. And when you're clashing with your number one player like you did with Marc Gasol, that's never going to end well. So, and I also heard, you know, David Fizdale kind of went in there with the attitude, like, you guys have no idea what it takes. I've won championships. It's different to say that if you're Eric Spoelstra going into Memphis. You're a coach, you know, Doc Rivers. But if you're David Fizdale, they're like, well, I mean, you were the assistant coach and you had LeBron James on your team. So I think he turned off some of the players. It didn't get off to a good start. It was a pretty quick ending for him. But I think if he's smart, and he seems to be a pretty smart guy, I think he's going to learn from that experience. And, you know, for a lot of these coaches, sometimes that second job, it's a lot better for them because they kind of have a better understanding of what it means to be a head coach, you know, things that work, things that don't work. And once again, he's walking into a situation where the Knicks are not expected to be a playoff team. So for him, year one is kind of a no-lose situation.
You know, my first question about Fizz is that, can he kind of tamp down the rhetoric? Because he doesn't seem to have much of a filter, and that's fine, you know, doing it in Memphis when you've got like one beat writer and a couple of TV stations. But every day in New York, I mean, if Porzingis is slow to come back, if he disagrees with something Porzingis is doing, does he have to change to be able to function in that market?
I think so. And I think what he'll realize is, you know, especially on game days when you're doing essentially three media availabilities, you know, you have to be careful what you say. And I think there's a lot of times guys come to New York and they get almost intimidated by the idea, oh, it's the biggest media market, I really, you know, have to step up my game when it comes to that, instead of just being yourself. And I'll give you an example of it. You know, at his press conference, you know, he talked about, you know, I never believed, you know, I'd be coaching the Knicks at Madison Square Garden. It's always something that I dreamed about. I'm thinking, you're an L.A. guy. You know, at a time when, like, Magic Johnson and Pat Riley are in L.A., you were really dreaming about coaching the Knicks back then? The Knicks were like crap when you were a kid. Like, so I mean, I think instead of just saying my dream was to one day coach the Lakers, now my dream is to play the Lakers in the NBA Finals and beat them. You know, it's almost like he thinks, I got to tell this story, because everybody does it, Chris. They come to New York and, like, I think it's in your contract. You must refer to the Madison Square Garden as the Mecca of basketball and say that the Knicks have the most educated fans. It's almost like everyone is required to do that. And I thought that was the only thing in this press conference where I said, you know what, you don't have to say that. You don't have to say that. Maybe it's true. I tend to doubt it as an L.A. guy who claimed he was a Laker fan, that his dream was to one day coach the Knicks. I don't buy that.
Yeah, so it was a solid hire, and it was done by Scott Perry in that front office and Steve Mills, the two guys that are now in charge. What did you note last year about the dynamic between those two? Because I wonder going in, I mean, would Steve Mills basically let Scott Perry run the show? Would it be a joint kind of arrangement? What have you noted in the last year about the way those two operate?
Well, yeah, they were spending a lot of time around the team, and it did seem like, you know, it was Scott's show to run. I thought the interesting dynamic for last season, and you know how this always works out this way, even though Steve Mills was on, it was in management when Jeff Hornacek was hired, it's still different when you bring in the GM and it's a different guy. So right away, maybe the media makes more of it, or maybe even the players do, but there always seems to be a difference in philosophies and the way things are going to be handled, and a lot of that kind of blew up with what happened with Joakim Noah. And I think we all knew which way it was headed with Jeff Hornacek, but it does seem like Steve and Scott are on the same page, and so far for them, things have worked out pretty well. You know, it looks like they have a good first-round pick, and I think for the Knicks front office, the big thing will be July 1st of 2019 and to see what players they can peg on the open market, because it looks like teams are going to have a lot of money and there's going to be some good players available.
Yeah, a lot of good players, and one of the carrots they're going to have to recruit them is going to be Porzingis. I mean, I don't know when he comes back. Maybe it's midseason. Maybe it's a little bit later. Who knows? But, you know, like he looks like a franchise player. Averaged 22 in the 48 games he played last year, improved, you know, every single season, almost 40% from three this past injury-riddled kind of season. Is he? Do you look at him as the kind of guy that's a real carrot for players to look at and say, I want to play with him?
I think the big question for him is going to be durability, because he's missed a lot of games in his first couple of years in the league. It doesn't look like he's going to be available for the start of the season. I would think for the Knicks, the key, if you're kind of gearing up for maybe sometime late March, early April, where you get him back out there and he's healthy enough to play again, and now you go into the offseason selling the idea of, you know, let's best case scenario, Kevin Knox is playing well, Frank Ntilikina has developed, and Porzingis is back to being healthy, and you have a lottery pick, now things might look different for a prospective free agent. And then you start talking about guys like Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant. Are they going to come to New York? I don't know, but at least if Porzingis is healthy, I think that's going to be the key. If he's healthy, you know, I could see a guy like Kevin Durant thinking about the possibilities. Same thing with Kyrie Irving. Not going to be easy to get either of those guys, but at least the Knicks would be in the running for it.
The, you know, the other young guy they have there that played, you know, pretty well last season was Frank Ntilikina. And I think my question with Ntilikina, Frank, is can he be kind of a full-time point guard? Now, he was sort of drafted as one, but, you know, shifted back and forth a little bit a couple of times between that position. They brought Emmanuel Mudiay in at one point to kind of tinker with him at the point guard spot. What do you see with Ntilikina? What's his next step?
You know, I was up at the Springfield for the Hall of Fame induction ceremonies, and two of the guys that went in, Jason Kidd and Steve Nash, one guy drafted by Dallas, but it really wasn't until, even though Jason Kidd won Rookie of the Year, you know, it wasn't really until he went to Phoenix, and then he was on his third team in New Jersey where he really blew up. And with Steve Nash, you know, he goes Phoenix, Dallas, and he played very well in Dallas. They won a playoff series with him, but it wasn't until that next stop. And it just seems like over the years, same thing with Chauncey Billups. You look at how he bounced around his career before kind of finally finding his game and, you know, finding a good spot for himself. I think with point guards, teams seem to be really, really impatient. And I think Frank has the work ethic, number one. He's very young. You know, he's coming to the league last year. He was 19 years old. I thought what the Knicks did, I didn't like some of the things that they had done. You know, they went out and they got Trey Burke, and then they went out and signed Emmanuel Mudiay, and it was like, why not just let it – you want to bring in one of those guys? I get it. But, like, why not invest the time in a guy like Frank and let him, you know, live with the growing pain point guard? It seemed like, I get it. It was, he was brought in by Phil Jackson, so this idea, well, he's not our player. I thought the Knicks were a little short-sighted with some of the things they did last year. And that's not a knock on Trey Burke, who actually played pretty well when the Knicks brought him in. Emmanuel Mudiay, not as much. But, like, why not dedicate yourself to seeing what you have here with Frank Ntilikina, who's a young guy who some people like, and if it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. But I thought they really confused him by bringing in a lot of players above him, you know, especially when you do that to a guy who was your first-round pick.
Does he have – do you feel like he has that kind of mental makeup to be a good player in New York? I mean, he got tossed around a little bit when Phil Jackson drafted him, and, you know, then Phil's gone. Now he's part of the team here. I mean, does he have that kind of mental toughness?
I think he does. My biggest question about him would be the athleticism. Offensively, he needs to get a lot better. But I think with a lot of the international players, when they come here, especially for a guy like that, you know, even though he speaks English, it's, you know, adjusting to a new culture, you know, speaking English more often to your teammates. And look at it. He gets drafted, and within a week, the guy that drafted him got fired. Mm. The poor guy's head had to be spinning. Then he shows up, and then, like, over the course of the year, they signed Trey Burke, and then they trade for Emmanuel Mudiay. So I think he went through a lot, and for the most part, I think he handled it pretty well. To me, the bigger question with him will be the athleticism and his offensive ability to really be able to kind of take that next step in the NBA.
Why is Joakim Noah still on the roster?
I think they're trying to figure out a way to get rid of him.
You know, I mean, it's September, weird, though.
I don't get it either. I don't get it. Maybe they're just hoping that, you know, there'll be some team out there that would be crazy enough to trade for him. It's kind of like the last, like, Phil Jackson move. You know, even though Phil is going to get credit, and rightfully so, for Porzingis, that's the move right there, like signing Joakim Noah, giving him all that money when it was clear that, you know, his body was starting to break down. And then last year, everything blew up out on the West Coast with he and Jeff Hornacek. The Knicks sent him home. And except for a couple of videos that he posts on Instagram, you don't really see or hear much from Joakim Noah. I can't imagine the Knicks are going to have him on the roster. I still think they're going to do something with him before training camp starts.
Are they waiting for your guy, Tom Thibodeau, to show that requisite craziness to make that move?
There's no way that's going to happen. I can't imagine that. Because I think any team, you know, he's not good enough that you would give up anything for him. He's the kind of guy where you would wait for him to get cut, kind of just like what Minnesota did or is doing with Lou Alden. You kind of wait for that guy to be available. He's not good enough to take on that kind of contract. It's a huge, huge contract. The only way the Knicks would have been able to get rid of it would be to attach him to a trade. You know, like we've heard about Charlotte trying to do that with players to get rid of their contracts, maybe attaching them to a player of value, somebody like Kemba Walker. Mm. But that's the only way the Knicks are going to get rid of Joakim Noah, short of doing the stretch provision on him and waiving him.
He gets cut. He's signing with Minnesota. Like, that's a lock.
I think so, too, and I think because Derrick Rose is there. It's like he'll have the whole gang back. He'll have
unbelievable.
Derrick Rose, unbelievable. Jimmy Butler, Joe
Taj
Kim
Gibson.
And Taj Gibson and Lou Alden.
Yeah. You got the 2011 maybe Bulls locked.
They'll bring Scal back.
Scal is often in videos busting up some of the locals. He's in the big three. He could probably still give you 5 to 10 minutes.
Not more than that.
Kevin Knox, any early thoughts on what you saw to him? I know that, you know, Knicks fans blew up my timeline in Summer League every time he played a good game.
Yeah, it's you know, he definitely has a live body. He looks like he's a big time athlete. You know, he's going to have the drive to want to get better. He's going to have to work on his shot. I just think it's funny about Summer League, and you know this from covering the NBA for a million years. There used to be Summer League took place, and, you know, then you went to training camp. Now guys are getting judged based on the first half of their first game of Summer League. Like Trey Young, his first game, everyone was killing the poor guy. Like, let it breathe a little bit. And there have been guys that have played well in Summer League over the years. I mean, Nate Robinson was like, what, a two-time, three-time MVP in Summer League? And
yeah, Jersey retired. NBA, Jersey retired in Summer League.
Exactly. It's like, you just calm down. It's like Glenn Rice Jr. was an MVP of Summer League. I think sometimes, because now every game is televised, and I think the sport is blowing up more so than ever, and the fans have this insatiable appetite for the young talent and kind of envisioning what they could be, I think everyone tends to exaggerate just a little bit. Look at a guy like Josh Hart on the Lakers, right, who played very well. But I don't know how much playing time he's going to get next season. So I think with some of that stuff, you have to be a little realistic about it. Let's just see how Kevin Knox plays this season, develops, and then in year two, that's really when he should be taking off.
I would say, I think, you know, you mentioned the guys that the Knicks brought in to play either, you know, instead of or over Neal Aquino, the Burks and the Mudiays. I think there's an appetite, Frank, in New York to play Kevin Knox a lot of minutes, you know, to kind of, as even a teenager, to kind of burn him out with that, you know, as a starter even maybe this year.
Oh, 100%. 100%. And once again, it's kind of a no-lose situation because he's young, number one, and he's a rookie. So I think when they drafted Porzingis, because he was taken so high And anytime you take an international player really high like that, and the Knicks fans, you know, of course, they'll all deny it now, they wanted Justice Winslow. So when Porzingis was drafted that high, he was judged differently. But then again, he won the fans over pretty quickly in his time there. But Kevin Knox, because nobody, even though he played a program like Kentucky, it wasn't like anybody really remembered anything that he had done at Kentucky. And he shows up at Summer League and he's dunking over people and everyone is getting excited about it. And when he plays this year, good or bad, it's always going to be, he's a rookie. Think about how much better he's going to get. Or he's a rookie. Don't get on him too much. So I think you're right. I think early on, it's going to be about Kevin Knox. And then as the season goes on, it's going to be about Porzingis, whether or not he's going to play again this season. It's
Justice Winslow. How many teams wanted Justice Winslow on draft night? I mean, Boston Chris, very nearly.
It's all because of the Final Four. Because for a lot of NBA fans, all they watch are like those three basketball games on the final March weekend. If they watch those three games, and Justice Winslow, to his credit, absolutely hit it out of the park. But come on. I mean, say what you want about Phil Jackson. That was a good pick. And Philadelphia is the team that really blew it because Porzingis would not only not work out for the Sixers, but he wouldn't provide them with any medical information. Mm-hmm. So, you know, who is it? I can't believe I forgot the GM. The GM
Sam
name Hankey. Of Philadelphia.
Sam Hankey.
Yeah. He decided not to take him. And they took Jahlil Okafor instead. And Phil, you know, Porzingis was available, and to his credit and the Knicks' credit, they took him, and it's worked out pretty well when he's been healthy.
Could you imagine a Porzingis, Joel Embiid front court? I mean, I don't know how with Ben Simmons thrown into that mix, I couldn't.
It wouldn't be bad. I mean, especially since Jahlil Okafor was struggling to get a job up until about a couple weeks ago when he finally landed with New Orleans.
Yeah. Let me finish with this. Best case scenario for the Knicks next season, when you take it all into account, you know, the need for a draft pick, playing young guys, signing guys in free agency, best case scenario when the season ends for New York?
Kevin Knox is good. Knicks have their lottery pick. Chris Porzingis is healthy. And then you go into free agency with maybe a chance for Kevin Durant, maybe a chance for Kyrie Irving. The big thing with both of them is, you know, Boston is so smart. I can't imagine that Danny Ainge is just going to let Kyrie Irving walked to New York. If Kyrie Irving leaves as a free agent and comes to New York, it's almost like buyer beware. I'd almost be worried that something's up. And then with Kevin Durant, the big thing will be he keeps taking, you know, he's been taking discounts in NBA terms to stay in Oakland, which is, and next year they're moving into that new building in San Francisco. And if he were to win this year, that gives him three championships. That gives him as many titles as LeBron. You know, if you stay in Golden State, maybe he can get a couple more out of there. Then he puts himself in kind of a different class than even LeBron James. So I think those are the two players on the Knicks' radar. I'm not saying that they can't get him, but I think it might be a little bit harder than maybe the Knicks fan wants to believe.
Do you think they understand, though, Frank? I mean, this group that, you know, learned the lessons from the past, like if you don't get the top two guys, don't go crazy on number three, four, and five?
Hopefully. Great call. Great call. Hopefully they did. And, you know, and that's when the Knicks got Amari Stoudemire. It was great because Amari had something to offer for a couple of years, but the Knicks gave him a 5-year contract, and of course Phoenix was not willing to do that because the information that they got was that his knees were eventually going to give out. And I think the Knicks, because they didn't get LeBron, and they thought maybe they had a chance for Dwayne Wade, I think they felt this, well, we have to get somebody. And that's where you got to be really careful. You know, sometimes you got to bite the bullet on that. So, and that's why for the Knicks, let's say, for example, they had a chance to get Jimmy Butler. Like, that's a guy who, you know, he's got a lot of miles on him. His body's been beaten up. Would you take a chance on him? I'd be a little worried about something like that. Kevin Durant, to me, is a no-brainer. In theory, Kyrie Irving is a no-brainer, but if the Celtics wouldn't want him or he just left without the Celtics trading him first, I'd be a little concerned about some of the knee injuries that he's had over the years.
Yeah, I think you'd want to know what the Celtics' offer was. Like Boston, if they think Kyrie's healthy, putting 5 years on the table at full max is not going to be, it's not going to be a problem for them. They'll do it. But if they don't think he is, or if they think there's any risk in year three, four, and five, that's why I've always said, Frank, they're not going to trade Terry Rozier until they decide what the future of Kyrie Irving is. Like if he's going to be part of their long-term stuff, that's it.
Are you worried about Kyrie Irving, or do you think, you know, he's had three procedures on his knee?
Yeah, in 2 years.
And he's only 27, but that's three procedures. Are you worried about him, or do you think he's the kind of guy that'll come back?
I'm a little concerned. I when they put out that, you know, so many people were like, oh, well, you know, he's going to be fine. They really got it this time. Like, every time I see that, I don't really believe it. So, I mean, look, he's had a lot of time off, so it's not like he's going to get rushed back in any way. Plus, he's playing for a team that is only going to play him 30 minutes a night. I mean,
they're
really good at that, and they've got, like, two lines they can put out there, so he's not going to be overextended. I think he has a really good year. That doesn't change that I'd be a little nervous if I'm New York or Boston or whoever about giving him a 4 or 5 year max contract, but for this year, I think he's going to be okay.
And what about Kevin Durant? Win or lose, what do you think the situation will be with him?
He's always had a wandering eye, you know? You know, you've got his agent is, I believe, New York based, and you know, he's I think he's going to have a blank canvas at age 30 when this season ends, and three championships that you can never take away from. I don't think he'd ever go to LA, because when you get to that level you were talking about, you don't want to play with LeBron. You want to compete with LeBron for those championships.
Yeah. But and think about it too. If you were to leave the Warriors and you say you went east, and we'll use the Knicks as an example, you know, you're getting out of the tougher conference, even though Boston is still a terrific team, and you got Philadelphia, you have Giannis and Antetokounmpo, but maybe Durant is thinking, I'm sure his agent probably trying to convince him, hey, you've already won with a great team in Golden State. You have your championships. Try to go to New York, and now you'll really separate yourself from a guy like LeBron James, that you were the guy willing to go to New York, and you returned them the glory.
Still in your peak, and still able to have four good years of playing at that level. Yeah, I think it's going to be – look, I think the one thing's for sure is that Kevin Durant is going to have a real free agency next summer. I don't think it's going to be like, even if they win a championship, I don't think it's going to be a quick signing of a contract. I think there's going to be a recruiting and all that goes into it with Kevin Durant. So
you mean we're going to be out in the Hamptons July 4th weekend?
I hope. Can somebody go somewhere fun, like somewhere?
Hey, I was out there this weekend and there were no NBA free agents. I wouldn't mind going out there again next July 4th and hanging out.
I'm not staking out the Hamptons. I'm not doing that. Frank, always appreciate it, man. Keep up the great work, and thanks for joining me here on the podcast.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
All right, before we get to Jeff McDonald of the San Antonio Express News, I got to tell my listeners about a great deal from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Support for the Yahoo Sports NBA podcast comes from our friends at Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, America's premier home purchase lender. Let's talk about buying a home. It can be one of the most important purchases that you'll ever make. But today's fluctuating interest rates can leave you with unexpected higher payments, which can turn a great experience into an anxious one. That's why Quicken Loans created their power buying process. Here's how it works. They check your income, assets, and credit to give you a verified approval. This gives you the strength of a cash buyer, making your offer more attractive to sellers. Once verified, you qualify for their exclusive Rate Shield approval. They'll lock your interest rate up for 90 days while you shop for your new home. Then, once you find the one, if rates have gone up, your rate stays the same. But if rates have gone down, you get to keep that new lower rate. Either way, you win. It's the kind of thinking you'd expect from America's largest mortgage lender. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/Mannix. That's rocketmortgage.com/Mannix. Rate shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records, equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org number 3030. All right, joining me now on the podcast, Jeff McDonald does a great job covering the Spurs for the San Antonio Express News. What's happening, Jeff?
Not much, just sitting around waiting for training camp so I can introduce myself to this entirely new roster of players that I'm going to have to meet.
Before we get into specifics, this has got to be like a first for you, like with covering this team and having this much drama around it.
Yeah, I mean, it was easily the most drama-filled, bizarre season that I've ever been a part of. I think that was my 11th, and just with this, you know, it actually, people don't remember, it started with the LaMarcus stuff, mm-hmm. where he's wanting to be traded, kind of, sort of, maybe, and then in September, instead of being traded, no, we extended him for 5 years, and so that was weird. And then like a day later, or a week later, you know, they're announcing Kawhi Leonard is out for the preseason with a quad injury, but everything's fine. Nothing to see here. You know, we'll get him back in short order and, you know, be ready to challenge the Warriors in the West. And then, you know, obviously that went way off the rails as the season went along.
Yeah. Well, let me just set that up then, because nearly two decades operating basically drama-free, the Spurs were, as Jeff pointed out, something of a soap opera last season. The franchise player, Kawhi Leonard, he battled with management, battled the season crippling injury, eventually traded this past summer. You had Manu Ginobili retiring now. Tony Parker defected to Charlotte. And for the first time in a long time, the Spurs' future is a little bit uncertain. But let's start with kind of a look back at a retrospective kind of Kawhi. Now that it's all over, where did it go wrong? Was it the injury, the handling of the injury, the veiled public shots about the injury, all of the above? Where did it go wrong?
You know, it's going to depend on which side of the argument you talk to. I mean, if you're talking to Kawhi's people, I don't say Kawhi because I don't think to this day, I don't think anyone has actually talked to Kawhi, and any reporter has been able to talk to a Kawhi and say, hey, man, like, what happened? Like, what, from your perspective, what went down? You're getting everything through, we're getting everything from his side through back channels, through his representatives, his uncle, Dennis Robertson, who's kind of had taken over his, you know, as his business manager. So, you know, some of the things you'd hear they complain about were the things you mentioned, just the handling of the injury. They think it wasn't diagnosed right. They believe it started as like at the end of the previous season, the Spurs medical staff had called it like a quad contusion and just sat him out for a while. And then they found some other doctors. It didn't heal right, in his opinion. They found some other doctors. With the Spurs' blessing, by the way, that everyone makes a big deal about him going to get a second opinion. The Spurs were fine with that. It's in the CBA that's his right. The Spurs even, you know, had to pay for that, for him to go to New York and get his New York doctors to find something else wrong with him. But there was just some, it was really the secrecy around that rehab in New York kind of started to make the Spurs wonder, like, something weird's going on here. Like, we can't, they had some of their people up there helping with the on-court stuff, but they weren't really getting all the medical information they thought they needed. You'd hear that his people were mad about, you know, Greg Popovich making reference to his group or just some of that stuff that was coming out maybe from the Spurs side, in back channel. The Spurs are like, if you talk to the Spurs people, you know, they're kind of like, we did everything we could to accommodate these people, this group of this contingent of people to accommodate Kawhi, to try to get him, you know, try to get him healthy and to let him do whatever he felt he needed to do. I mean, they kind of felt like they bent over backwards for him. And there's sort of a suspicion that Kawhi's group was just kind of using the whole episode as a means to sort of grease the skids out of town. You know, some people, I hate, that seems like a Trumpian thing to do. Some people are saying, but some people seem to think that, you know, Uncle Dennis, as he's derisively known in San Antonio now, is trying to start his own agency and wants Kawhi to be the face of it and wanted to get into some sort of a bigger market in order to do that and use sort of the kerfuffle over his quad injury as a means to sort of grease the skids and do that. So there's still a lot we don't know, and there's still a lot of he said, she said kind of stuff floating around that thing.
I found the evolution of Uncle Dennis Robertson, the uncle of Kawhi Leonard, you said, to be fascinating. Because, I mean, Kawhi, you know, when he was coming up, I mean, you know, this terrible interview, but when I did stories on him, Uncle Dennis was like this invaluable resource. Like, he was just like a storyteller. He would, you know, gregarious type of guy. Now it seems like he had injected himself at the root of the problems between Kawhi and the Spurs.
Yeah, and I always try to, like, I empathize with everyone that I'm involved in a story like this. And you look at Kawhi, you know, and I might be projecting here. I've never asked him this question because we haven't talked to him in so long, but, you know, Kawhi's a guy whose, you know, father is, you know, murdered he's killed in a pretty horrific fashion when Kawhi is a child. And so he doesn't have his father figure in his life. And Uncle Dennis kind of became that to him. And so, of course, Kawhi is going to listen to Dennis Robertson now. And, you know, this is a guy that's always been in my life, has always been there for me, who's, you know, kind of been my father since my father has passed. And so you can sort of understand why Kawhi would latch onto him and sort of let him drive the train. It just became bizarre for us covering the team. We could never, you know, they'd even made Kawhi available a couple of times throughout the year, but it was just pablum and just Kawhi stuff. Yeah, I'm fine. Yeah, I'm working hard to get back. Just stuff. It was almost unusable because it was just cliched and didn't really enlighten you at all. You never got the sense Kawhi understood what was going on with the whole situation and how he was being portrayed and what they, you know, what bridges were being crossed and burned. And maybe Kawhi understood all that, but we never got a chance to talk to him about it. And when we did, a few times we did, he just didn't seem like he was in charge of his own career at that point. But that's just the way it seems. Maybe he's completely running everything behind the scenes, but we never saw that from him, never really got that sense from him.
Lastly on Kawhi, we heard the public statements from Tony Parker, you know, my injury was worse. You know, Manu Ginobili said some things. Did he lose the locker room? Did his teammates, did their perception of him change last season?
I think that's absolutely fair to say. I think it's funny because taking the Parker comment, for example, I think you have two, the fans have sort of lined up on two sides of that. Some of them are like, yeah, you can't say that about Kawhi, and we get that why Kawhi was so upset with that. And then there's the other side where the fans are like, oh, Tony didn't mean it the way it came out, and he's taken out of context. And I think the truth is somewhere in the middle of that, because at that point in time, it was in March, they were getting a little fed up or with what was going on or with not knowing what was going on, the rest of the locker room. There were a couple times in March where it was like, he's coming, his group, as Pop calls them, had come to Pop and said, okay, we're looking at this game. This is the game Kawhi is going to come back in March. We have this targeted. And it'd be like the morning of, and they'd call and say, well, no, not this one. And then it would be another one, you know, a couple of days down the line or a week down the line. It would happen two or three times. And, the players would hear about it and be excited, like, we're getting Kawhi back. Now we're going to make our big playoff push. And then it wouldn't happen. And they were getting let down. And so I think that was sort of the impetus behind the infamous team meeting that Tony Parker spearheaded somewhere there in March. I remember it was March 17th after they had beaten Minnesota at home. They gather everybody in the locker room, and basically the thing is, Kawhi, what's the deal? And, you know, there are two ways of looking at that, that maybe Kawhi kind of felt they were coming at him. Others might say, we were just asking the question, like, what's mm-hmm. the deal? Are you going to play? Are you not going to play? What's going on? And they didn't get satisfying answers from that. Kawhi, from all accounts, got a little upset by that confrontation. And then a couple weeks later, or maybe even just a week later, is when you get that Parker quote about my injury was 100 times worse. And the context of that was, it was a question just about, the difficulty Kawhi must be having, getting back and how the frustration he must be feeling. So really just a general, almost bad question. And so Parker's answer was kind of along the lines of, yeah, I understand what he's going through. You know, I had a similar injury. In fact, mine was 100 times worse, and I know how hard it is, and he just has to stay positive and blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. So when you heard it live, that quote live, it almost didn't really hit you as he's throwing shade. It's just when you saw it, that little sentence taken out, slapped in a headline and going viral, that it sort of became like, oh yeah, he's this is not going to go over well with Kawhi's camp. And so I think on the one hand, I don't think Tony really meant to take a huge shot, but I just think there was this background of distrust and disappointment and frustration that had already just made it where that stuff was going to start to bubble up. So I think that's kind of what happened there. But that was one thing that Kawhi's camp was really upset about, was quote unquote Tony Parker taking shots at Kawhi's toughness and injury and stuff like that.
So Kawhi is out. You have DeMar DeRozan, Jakob Poeltl, top 20 protected first round pick coming in that deal. What they got back, Jeff, what does that tell you about the direction the franchise is trying to take?
It really seems like, and I don't know if this is, I mean, you're going to trust the Spurs front office because they've earned it, but it seems like they're trying to split the difference between we want to still be competitive for the playoffs right now, but we also want to use this to gather some assets to build for the future. And I don't know. It feels like a little bit of a half measure, maybe. I mean, I don't know. There were some offers out there where they could have just loaded up on future first round picks and gotten back, you know, not great NBA players right now, but first round picks, and you're not going to make the playoffs and you're going to hit the lottery and have another first, you know, have a lottery pick out of that. And they could have used that to sort of build to the future. I don't know that there was a deal out there that was going to get them, just a whole package of guys that equal Kawhi Leonard in the short term, so I don't even know if that was an option. But it just tells me that this group is a proud group, and they're not going to go into a season saying, we don't think we're going to make the playoffs. I think Pop's just been around too long. He's at the end of his career. RC's been here too long. They're not going to do what Philadelphia did or some of these other teams did and accept lottery seasons to rebuild in the wake of losing a franchise superstar. They're just not going to do it. And I don't know if it's the right call or the wrong call. I think that will play out. But you know, they're not going to be a championship contender this year, I don't think. I think it's fair to say they could fight for a playoff spot in the West. So you wonder what that looks like 5 years from now. What this roster is going to look like 5 years from now, 3 years from now, when they could have stocked it with a lot of first round picks. But I'm not saying that's the wrong move. It depends on what your goals are. If your goals are, we are not going to be in the lottery, we're the Spurs, damn it, then I think they made a deal that was good for them. I didn't think there was a chance after everything that unfolded that they were going to get an all-star back for Kawhi. I didn't think that was even a possibility, and they did that. So if that was your goal, to be a team that's going to fight for 50 wins in a playoff spot, then they did pretty good. Again, I don't know what it's going to look like 4 or 5 years from now when a lot of this roster turns over just from age.
Greg Popovich is 69 years old, be 70 middle of next season. Do you think that his age and, you know, clearly a finite time that he's going to be on the bench had anything to do with what they got back for Kawhi Leonard?
They would probably deny that, but it makes sense to me. I mean, what does Pop want to do with a 5-year rebuilding project? You know, I mean, that what's the point of that if you're him? So, he would probably tell you that it had nothing to do with it, but I think it probably does. You're looking at, like, as I mentioned, he's at the end of the line, whether it's this season or next or two more after this, but I mean, he doesn't want to spend the end of his career in the lottery. Like that's just not what he wants to do. So I think you're probably right that, that played into this idea that we want to keep winning as many games as we can right now, even if it doesn't necessarily make us a championship contender or a valid threat to the Warriors.
You mentioned, you know, fighting for the playoff spot last year. I mean, the Spurs won 47 games with Kawhi only playing in 9 total. They add a DeMar DeRozan. You can argue, I know Ginobili gone, Parker gone. You can certainly make an argument that they're a little bit better, considering Kawhi didn't play last season of the team we saw last year. Do you think they're better on paper?
They're going to be better offensively. They're going to be able to score more this year. I mean, you took your leading scorer off of last year's team, basically. And so their offense really suffered, even though LaMarcus Aldridge had a fantastic year on that end. So you replaced basically the 9 games you got from Kawhi Leonard with, 82 of DeMar DeRozan. You'd think your offense will improve some. You know, they added some other pieces along the periphery too, like a Marco Bellinelli, or who will give them someone who can make a 3-pointer, and that sort of thing. And they've got some guys, probably the most casual NBA fans have not heard of, but guys that they're kind of have groomed, like this guy Derek White, who's a combo guard who'd probably come off the bench. He was their first-round pick last summer from Colorado that they're really high on. So they've got some scoring. I think they'll be a better scoring team. I'll be interested to see what happens with the defense. Now, they had the number 2 defense in the league last year without Kawhi. You lose him. But some of the guys that made that happen, Danny Green is gone. A lot of people don't realize Kyle Anderson had a great defensive year. He's gone to Memphis. So they've lost a lot of those pieces, and that to me will be kind of interesting to see what happens there. If they can rebuild their defense into a top 10, top 5 defense with the pieces they have, and improve offensively the way it looks like they can on paper, I think they can have, you know, a pretty decent year. And the one thing I'll say about them defensively is they seem to get more, like you look at them on paper and you're like, well, DeRozan can't guard anybody. He's not, you know, he's a clear downgraded defensively. The Spurs tend to get more out of individual players defensively than they've shown before. So I'm not saying DeRozan is going to be an all defensive player, but I think he can be better. You look at like LaMarcus Aldridge, nobody thought of him as a defensive player in Portland. He's been pretty good for them defensively since he arrived here. So I think they have a system and they have a way of coaching defense that I think their defense will probably be better than it looks on paper. And if it can be that and they can actually score, you know, I think they'll have, you know, they can be back in that 50-win, that 50-win tier. I mean, it's going to be hard. Everyone knows the West is unbelievably difficult. It always is. And now you've added LeBron James to that mix. So maybe just what the Spurs have done isn't going to be enough to even keep. There's like a, you know, the optimistic Spurs fans around here will say, well, they won 47 games last year with no Kawhi Leonard. If they just had DeMar DeRozan last year, they would have won 55, you know, easily. I don't know if that kind of math works exactly. Maybe it does, maybe it doesn't, but because the West has gotten so much better. But I think like some of the Vegas odds had them in like 43 for the over-under. I would take the over on that.
Yeah. Yeah, I would too. I mean, you mentioned Aldridge, and he was Portland Aldridge, you know, last year. The shots were up around that level. The scoring was up around that level. Shot better than 50% from the floor for the first time in a long time last year. I'm interested to see how Jeff, he plays with DeRozan, how they play off each other, what they try to do with a guy like DeRozan offensively. But is this kind of Aldridge's team now? Do they play through him in the same way as they did last year?
I don't know. I think with DeRozan, that does have to change some stuff. A lot of DeRozan's game is sort of Kawhi-esque offensively, a lot of mid-range stuff, and I think he'll be a big part of that. I would assume that Aldridge's shots are going to go down this year, and that's probably for the better, I think. I mean, one of the things you worry about if you're the Spurs is, you know, that whole thing where they won 47 last year, and if you just plug the DeRozan into this, they're obviously going to be better. Like, LaMarcus had, like, really a career year last year. Like, even compared to his Portland years, that might have been his best all-around season. I don't know that he can repeat that at age 33. Maybe he can, but if he takes even a little bit of a step back, like you might expect for a big man that is aging, somebody's going to have to pick up that slack. And obviously, it's nice to have a DeMar DeRozan in there to do that. But as far as things like face of the franchise, it's kind of crazy. The longest tenured guy now on this team, like for the whole time I've covered them, they've had a Tony Parker and a Manu Ginobili. And for like 10 of those years, they had a Tim Duncan. Like they were just like the team that, like you didn't, like the media guide was cut and paste every year. Like they didn't have to rewrite the media guide because it was the same guys every year. Their longest tenured player right now is Patty Mills, who came at the end of the 2010 season, I think, 2010-11 maybe. Their second longest tenured player, the guy who's been here the second longest, is LaMarcus Aldridge, who really still seems like a new Spur to me. So that there's he's the face of the franchise kind of by default because there's nobody else.
I refuse to get too excited about what I see in Summer League. You get, you know, kind of Charlie Brown and Lucy out of that when you get too giddy about that stuff. But, you know, Lonnie Walker looks pretty good. Like, looks like he's got some skills. Looks like he can shoot a little bit. Looks like he can, you know, ball him a little bit. Does he have a role with that team this year?
That's going to be another thing to really kind of monitor this year. You know, I think most years you'd say almost no matter who he is, if he's a rookie and he's 19 years old and he's coming in to the Spurs, there's probably going to be like a long stint in Austin involved. I mean, the only, like, Kawhi Leonard's the only guy, well, George Hill and Kawhi Leonard are the only rookies coming in that have kind of been given pretty major roles their first year. Even guys, you know, these guys end up in Austin in the D League, bouncing back and forth. You know, if we're not going to play him in the NBA, it takes a long time to earn Pop's trust. So if we're just going to sit him on the bench here for the first half of the year, we'll just put him in Austin. So a lot of times I would say that's probably where what happens with Lonnie Walker his first year. But, A, he's a lot more talented than a lot of the rookies that they've had coming in. And B, this is just a team that's in flux. I mean, there's almost like a why not? Why not throw him out there for a while and let him play and see what he's got? We did see that in summer league. Like at least once a game in those summer league games, he would break off a move that nobody else on this roster is going to be able to break off. Like he's just got that kind of skill level to him. You just wonder about he's 19. Defense is maybe a foreign concept to him right now. Like he'll have to learn that and dedicate himself to that. But he's definitely a guy that they're high on, if not this season, then down the road. I mean, I think he's, you know, he is the highest drafted rookie that they've had at 18 since Tim Duncan. Kawhi Leonard was a trade. That's kind of fudging the stat a little bit. But as far as original draft picks, he's the highest drafted guy that they've had since Tim Duncan. And so that he's a guy that they're going to, I mean, look at long and hard and give a chance to play. And you know, he's got some special skills. Pop, kind of the one time we talked to Pop this summer, kind of after the Kawhi trade, we were just hitting him with every offseason question we could think of. And he said it's going to be a lot like when we had Monta Ginobili the first as a rookie, where half the time you don't know what the hell this guy is doing, what he's trying, but you just know he's got some special something that you just have to live with it. You have to learn to live with it and let him, you know, Pop had to let Monta Ginobili be Monta Ginobili. And what Pop said now is I'm probably going to have to just learn to let Lonnie Walker be Lonnie Walker.
Mm-hmm. Before I let you go, Becky Hammon quietly promoted to the front of the bench, replacing James Borrego, who got the job in Charlotte. You've been around Becky since she came to the Spurs as an assistant coach. This is the next step in her progression as a coach. What do you make of her? What do you hear from the Spurs as far as her, you know, potential as a coach down the line? What are your observations?
You know, my dealings with her as a reporter, I mean, you can see why everyone just loves her. Like you talk to her for like a newspaper article and then you just want to go play for her and run through a wall for her because she just has that sort of motivating way about her. Just the way she carries herself, she has a message a lot of times that resonates and a career that resonates. And so, you know, you can see why people want to play for her. But what I love what the Spurs have done with her is like when she first was hired, obviously it's big national news that there is a female, first full-time female assistant in the NBA. So, you know, the Spurs can't ignore that. They have to trot her out for the requisite interviews for the national outlets and for us and for everyone else. And so they did a round of that. And that's the story, you know, that she's the first female assistant, blah, blah, blah. But after that, they've really gone out of their way to downplay the gender angle altogether. I mean, she's a coach. She's a basketball coach. She's on, you know, the same level as Ime Udoka and Ettore Messina and how James Borrego was. I mean, she's one of the guys, even if she's not a guy. And I think the Spurs did a good job of, you know, making everyone realize that she's just a coach. And everybody, I mean, everyone you talk to says she's as good at her job as anyone. I mean, as any of the male coaches. And like it was a weird push-pull with her because the Spurs don't want her to be seen as some like carnival act where she's on you know, a girl on the bench. But she's also got this inspirational story that can inspire a lot of other women and young girls around the city and around the world. And so I think Becky has done a good job of walking that line of, you know, talking about it, being like, I want girls to look at me and see that, you know, you can do this. If this is what you want to do with your life, you can do this. If you want to, you know, do this or that or any other occupation, like your gender doesn't hold you back at all. While also just downplaying the whole novelty of it I mean, it's a weird kind of push-pull that they've been able to pull off. That's just with us. But basketball-wise, she's really sharp and motivating. And, like, the players just treat her like all the other coaches. And I think that's all you can really ask for. And she's definitely a coach that's sort of on the rise. I mean, I think you can say that.
She's gotten her first flickers of interest as a head coach. Do you think she could be a head coach in waiting in San Antonio?
That is a good question. The thing about Becky is she's still very early in this journey. Like when a lot of people, you got a lot of people like mad she didn't get one of these jobs this summer. And you're like, slow down. Like, you know, nothing against her, but she was just hired like 3 summers ago. Like most assistant coaches, and maybe there are some, but most of the time you don't go from very first assistant coach job to a head coach job in 3 years. Like that doesn't really seem to happen all that much. So she's got some dues to pay, really. I mean, and I think she would tell you that one, and she would want that. She wouldn't want to be fast-tracked just because of her name or the fact that she's a woman or the fact that, you know, it could be a nice little public interest story for some market that isn't really in it for the basketball. I think, you know, she's got some dues to pay, and she will pay them. And I think at some point, she will be on a lot of lists for a head coaching job. I don't, like, if Pop retires next summer, I don't know that Becky Hammon is the number one choice for that job. I don't know that she's not, but I there are other people on the bench that have been here longer and have put in more time. But she's a person that eventually, somewhere down the line, if she continues to build this career, I think you're going to start to hear her name a lot more as jobs come open.
Yeah, well, should be interesting. Interesting season in San Antonio, to say the least, coming up. Jeff, always appreciate the time. Keep up the great work, man, and I'll see you out there.
All right, we'll see you soon.
That's it for this week's episode. My thanks to Frank Izzola and Jeff McDonald for joining the show. As always, you can download archived episodes on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, really anywhere you can download podcasts. While you're there, post a comment, leave a rating. You know I appreciate it. And I'll see you next week.